long time ago when the earth was green, and there was more kinds of animals than you'd ever seen. They'd run around free when the earth was being born, but the loveliest of them all was the unicorn. There was green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-backed camels and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but
let me take you back in time.
The loveliest of all was the unicorn.
So there I would be at home, I'd be watching the Ray Rayner Show, and then I'd hear that song, and this man, Dr. Lester Fisher, then the director of the Lincoln Park Zoo, would come on with an animal or two or three or four, kind of like, well, how Jack Hanna has done it many, many years later. But he was the first to do it, and he did it right here in Chicago, the director of the Lincoln Park Zoo for many years. Dr. Lester Fisher, welcome to Steve Dale's Other World.
Steve, you make me smile, and it's nice to hear your voice. And that music was indeed kind of a fun thing because the kids used to follow me around the zoo singing that song.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
Ray was everyone's favorite,
yes,
you know.
Yes. Well, at one point in time, you were everyone's favorite. So let me draw a picture here for folks who may not be old enough to know. There was a time before Animal Planet. And at that point, I think it was Marlon Perkins, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, who was the first, and he had a sidekick, Jim Fowler, and it seemed Marlon was always in the studio saying, well, I am here in the comfort of the studio. Jim is, as you can see, wrestling an alligator in the Everglades, and they'd cut to Jim. But that was the only show of its kind, and Marlon Perkins was at the zoo in St. Louis, but he began in Chicago, actually.
You bet. He was my predecessor here, and you're forgetting that Marlon also had a show called Zoo Parade that started here in Chicago, Steve. That was in the early, early years of television in the late 1940s.
So did you think when you took over for Marlon Perkins, I have to reach out, the Lincoln Park Zoo needs to reach out to the general public?
Well, I thought to myself, a lot of people kept asking me when I took the job, are you going to be on TV? Because Marlon was such an incredible, good marketer. And I always said, no, I'm not a TV person. And then WGN called me and said, would you consider doing a show? And I said, sure, why not? And so that's what started my time with your station.
Well, and in fact, that continued for many, many years. How long were you the director of the Lincoln Park Zoo?
I was there for 30 years, Steve.
And so much, so much.
Before that, I was a part-time doctor for about 15 years. I had a small animal hospital practice and took care of the zoo medically as a part-time endeavor and hobby.
And for those who don't know, you're a veterinarian, and have long been involved in Chicago animal welfare in many ways, aside from being director of the Lincoln Park Zoo for all those years. So all those years ago, I was a docent at the Lincoln Park Zoo. And one of the reasons why I do, and I've told you this before, but you're going to have to sit through it again, my friend, is that I do what I do. It's because of the people that have come before me that have influenced me. And growing up as a kid, I would sit with my dad, and we would watch shows like Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. Zoo Parade was a bit before my time. I know about the show, but but I used to watch you as well. And I thought, you know what? This is the most fascinating thing. And I would learn because it was the only place on television. You could read about animals. You could go to the zoo. But on television, you were it in Chicago, aside from the national show that Marlon Perkins did. And we watched those shows together. So you had an influence on me from me just watching you on TV. But then later, when I was a docent at the zoo and had the opportunity to get to know you, you really did make an impact, not only on myself, but bigger picture, I think, on the zoo world, particularly with great apes.
Steve, you're flattering me and making me feel real good inside, and I'm sort of humbled by your comments. I recently talked to a doctor who told me that he switched to medicine because I gave a lecture on biology at DePaul University, and he was interested in something else, and he decided to go to medicine. That made me feel great.
As it should, you know. And now I guess I've gotten to an age where I've gone to veterinary conferences, and it's crazy to me to even think, but it's happened several times now where people have come up to me and have said, I'm a veterinarian or I'm a veterinary technician, Steve, because of you. But that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for you, because I wouldn't be doing what I do for a living today.
Steve, and you do it very well, and that's why you're so welcome all over town.
Well, thank you very much. But I want to talk about zoos and how zoos have changed so very much. And the reason why I even brought this up is one of my jobs, and I was the—I don't know that you know this. I was the last person to do the chimpanzee tea party. So a great lady by the name of Pat Sass, who has passed away, was then the curator of the Children's Zoo. And I would come out to do this tea party in an outdoor amphitheater, held maybe 150 or so people. And at that time, Chimmy, a young chimpanzee, would pull me out on a red flyer wagon. And I would talk about chimpanzees, and we'd do this little tea party demo. And then Chimmy would go back, and I'd come out with a ferret or a bunny rabbit or something. I suspect that you would agree with me that in 2017, that could never, should never happen. But all those years ago, it's what zoos did.
That's right. And the tea party started because one of our park commissioners, Franklin Schmick, went to London and saw the zoo there, and they had tea time with chimps. And he came home and said, Les, why can't we have tea time in Chicago? And that's how it started, Steve.
Really? Well, at that time, the Chicago Park District had a great deal of influence, I believe, regarding the Lincoln Park Zoo. It's run a little differently today, but I'll tell you one thing that's not changed, and I was just at the zoo. One thing that's not changed, it's easy to say I was just at the zoo because it's a free zoo. It's in the heart of Chicago. You pay for parking now, but the zoo itself, you could just walk through. If you live in the neighborhood, people do this all the time, I know. They jog through the zoo. It's absolutely free.
Well, I'm biased about it, Steve, but I will say this. The zoo has been and still is one of the happy places in town. It's one of the neutral turfs where 20, 30,000 people on a summer Sunday can get together and all, you know, everything goes well.
But it is a different world today. So I just did a blog post about, and I suspect you've heard, that Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus said no more elephants. And shortly after they said that, they said no more circus. Things do change. And I've been asked many times how I felt about that. I wrote a blog about it as well. I'm glad it happened, is my perspective. I don't think elephants, I think today we know their life can be better. I also don't know that the training methods are as enriching or positive, for whatever reason, in the circus as they are, in fact, for zoos that have elephants. But there's even a question as to whether zoos should have elephants.
Well, that happily has changed, Steve, because way, way back, you may recall, we had one lone elephant, Judy.
Yeah.
And she lived at Lincoln Park Zoo for many, many years and died at the age of about 65. But Lincoln Park no longer has elephants because unless you have a place, physical space for a social group, you really shouldn't have them. And that's the reason that the decision was made at Lincoln Park not to replace elephants. And many zoos now around the country are also thinking of the welfare, not only of the elephant, but of all the animals in their care.
Well, I think that's the biggest issue there is, the welfare of all the animals in their care. And as you know, I speak at veterinary and animal welfare conferences, and one of the topics I love speaking about is enrichment. And I begin the talk by saying, I believe, and I do believe, that the average sun bear, the average chimpanzee, even the average green iguana at a good zoo has more enrichment opportunities and in some ways has therefore a more interesting life than our dogs and cats at home. And one day, I mean, that's the line I use. And one day,
that's a good one.
I said that, and all these people applauded. And wouldn't you know, I had the first two row of people there that did work at a zoo.
So. Oh, that's a nice story, Steve. But there's no question about it that originally at Lincoln Park Zoo, the so-called time to come was 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the big cats were given a big hunk of horse meat, and that was considered, you might say, a good way to care for them. And there was no enrichment. They just kind of lived their life. And one of my goals when I became director was to take the animals out of that environment and create a better home for all of them.
And today, I mean, do you agree with the statement that animals in zoos do have a very enriching life, and again, in some ways more so than what we provide our pets?
Well, I think the pets can be spoiled easily at home by many people, but yes, there's no question that the keepers and the curators and the staff are all committed to their animals, and the animals do lead the best possible life they can. Most of them, happily, now have been born in a zoo, so we no longer take animals from the wild. Generally speaking, the mammals, I think over 90% of mammals in our zoos today in America are captive-born.
Explain how this works. I think there's, you know, so I'm glad about the concern the general public has regarding animal welfare. Overall, it's vastly different than it was, say, 25 years ago. On the other hand, I also think there are some misconceptions. So explain a bit about the species survival program, and along with that, what the place is scientifically of zoos around the world, not only in America.
Well, the species survival plan started with a conservation issue of what do we do about making sure that our animals will have a full normal life in a captive state. And the certain species that were designated by the National Zoo Association, such as tigers, elephants, primates, other animals, a committee was formed of 10 representative people from the different institutions that house these animals. And they would get together once a week and decide what is the best possible breeding program to minimize inbreeding issues. And it's been very successful. And zoos also, of course, trade animals to help that program. There no longer are any dollar signs connected to it. It's just what's best for the animal world.
So in other words, let's talk about that a little bit. There's a species of leopard called an Amur leopard. They're
right.
Very endangered. So to keep the genetic pool as robust as possible, a zoo from over there may trade, if you will, with a zoo over there. So the zoo over there has an Amur leopard breeding that is more genetically appropriate for the animal that is the female, if we're talking getting a male, that for the female that's already there. It's all about the genetics, and it's all about propagating species.
Correct. And the idea is that it's not only a national thing now, it's international. And so all of the so-called better accredited type zoos around the world participate and happily help each other in this area.
Let me ask you a personal question, if I can. I believe you and my friend Betty White, who celebrated recently her 95th birthday, have a lot in common about loving animals, primates in particular. But you're, I don't know how to say this, but you're over the age of 75?
Yes, I happily am senior to Betty. I just sent her a nice note congratulating her on her 95th birthday and reminded her that I'm always going to be her senior by 1 year. so Betty and I have enjoyed a wonderful long relationship.
So Betty White is a young buck to you, huh?
Right. But she truly is committed to the animal world, no question about it.
You're the only person I know that can walk up to Betty White and say, "How you doing, kid?"
Oh, Steve, it's always so much fun to chat with you about animals because you've become so involved in the Chicago area and all the animal welfare issues, and I respect that very much.
Well, coming from you, that's the best compliment in the world that I can possibly receive. So you've known Betty White all these years. You've been around the animal world and the zoo world for all these years. So I just wrote that piece about elephants that I alluded to. The circus no longer has them. There will no longer be a circus. But what I wrote in the piece is that I'm glad about, I don't want to see the circus die, but I'm glad that elephants aren't there anymore. But my concern is bigger. My concern are for the elephants being poached in Africa, the elephants that are pulled from as babies from their moms for tourists in Asia. And now with everyone having phones, there's video of that, and you see mother elephants actually scream. We are still learning about elephant, as smart as we are, we're still learning about elephant communication. We don't completely even understand the depth of their emotions as well Correct. As how they communicate with one another. As one example, so I ask you this question, are you concerned about the future? I mentioned Amur leopards. I don't know how many there are in the wild, but we're talking hundreds, I think, not
yes,
many thousands.
Yes, not talking more than hundreds.
Yeah. So are you concerned about all of these species and, frankly, at the end of the day, about the planet and about us?
Well, I'm concerned in this sense that the wildlife are entitled to their life on our planet just as we are. I think that there's no question the way the trends have gone in the last 20 to 30 years that national parks and zoos, the so-called accredited good zoos, are going to be possibly the last home for many wild creatures. And I think that as there are more and more people on Earth and we need more and more space to feed them, that puts a bigger so-called limitation on the place for the wildlife. So all of us who have been in conservation work for a long time have this genuine concern, and we're hopeful that things may kind of settle out.
So for some species, the zoos are already the only place in which they live. I mean, you can rattle off names of animals, species, where they only survive in zoos today, and the hope is to one day introduce at least some of these back. But the problem is, as you allude to, there's no place to introduce them back to. And I don't want to get depressing here, but I know you have, for example, a personal love for great apes. I had the opportunity, I don't know that you know this, about 2 years, 3 years ago, myself, to go to Africa to see the mountain gorillas, which is a life-changing experience. But the mountain gorilla is the only species of great ape. The chimpanzees, the bonobo or pygmy chimpanzee, the orangutan species in particular, the lowland gorilla species or subspecies, I mean, they're all in serious decline every single day. And the only thing that keeps the mountain gorilla going are tourists and the money the tourists bring in.
The government of Rwanda have realized and benefited from tourism coming to see these wonderful animals. And I did not know that you had that privilege to do that, Steve. And it's a highlight of any animal person's life to be able to go and see the mountain gorillas in their home, and you're a visitor watching them.
Why was it you used to lead these trips? Why is it so? I mentioned it was life-changing. The EcoTours guide that brought us up there, a great organization because they give back to the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, which I know you know about. He said that people go up and they weep, they cry. I was pretty much on the verge of tears. What do you think it is about seeing mountain gorillas in particular? And there are no bars, no cages. As you point out, it's where they live. That is so life-changing or inspiring to people.
Well, it's an effort to get to them because they are living up in anywhere from 6 to 9, 10,000 feet altitude, and the woods or jungle that they're in is really difficult to walk in. And I think just to be able to see the action, watch the big silverback and the youngsters, and occasionally some of them even come close to the visitor. You're asked to sit down and not move or say anything, and just to get that experience of this creature coming over to say hello, literally, and wonder why you're there, is just it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience for an animal person, Steve.
It truly is. So let me kind of weave back to where I was going, and I'm struggling a bit because I don't want to sound depressing, but the world is different than it was 25 years ago. 25 years from now, experts some suggest for some animals, zoos will be the last place in which they live. Others suggest that those are the lucky ones, and some may not be on this planet altogether, which may include, by the way, orangutans that will be in zoos. But here you have this relative of ours just a couple of chromosomes away.
Right.
And they may be gone except in zoos for forever. I mean, are you depressed? Are you concerned? Will life, I mean, what do you think?
Well, I personally am extremely concerned about the future of wildlife. And the good news is that there's more recognition of the need to be concerned. I think the fact that the so-called old zoo of 50 years ago, which was literally a barred cement jail for creatures, is no longer considered proper. And I think the fact that recently there was this fact, I think, that the Chinese government are trying to cut back on the ivory trade. I think that a lot of people now understand the issues, and I think that one can be hopeful that we'll do the best we can for the remaining creatures that are part of our life.
So for those of us hearing this conversation and hearing at this point in time, I mean, you're clearly one of the experts. What can we do? What can the average person do to make a difference?
I think the main thing is to support conservation groups that are valid, and we're talking both plant and animal, so that I think places such as the Audubon Society that specialize in birds, other groups that look, after the land issues, I think that people should get involved. I think people should not hesitate to give some time and funding to help the good groups do the work that they need to do. And I think if things like that happen, that'll be good. Again, one can say how lucky we are in Chicago with two great zoos, Brookfield Zoo and Lincoln Park. Visit them often, and we shouldn't forget our neighbor, Milwaukee.
Yeah.
The county zoo up there is indeed a joy. So that we're blessed with that type of facility.
In Dr. Fisher's Life on the Ark, that's a book you wrote a couple of years ago, you write about and remember some pretty incredible stories. And I don't know if they're all true even, Dr. Fisher.
Steve, we could spend the day telling stories. In fact, that's why I wrote the book. I asked a friend one day, you know, I'd like to do something about the zoo, and he said, you're always sharing stories, so why don't you write it? And that's how the book came about, Steve.
The most legendary gorilla in America ever, arguably, is a dude by the name of Bushman. Talk about Bushman a little bit, and your relationship, by the way.
I was fortunate, in spite of old age, to be one of the doctors who took care of Bushman. At that time in history, there were two famous gorillas in America, Gargantua, the circus, and Bushman here in Lincoln Park. And he came here as a youngster. He lived to be about 21 or 22 years old. The media enjoyed doing a lot of stories about him because he would react to media stuff. And Bushman was just such an incredible 550-pound lowland gorilla. And he had an aura about him, and I was amazed when I've gone to the Field Museum and talked to people there. He still is the third most popular exhibit in the wonderful Field Museum. where you'd think there are so many other great exhibits. So Bushman just was one of a kind, and my frustration as a doctor at that time was that there's no easy way to get to him. We didn't have the restraint drugs that we have today. We didn't have the capture gun that would deliver the restraint guns, and so we just had to try and give him medicine through the food and water approach, and we did the best we could for Bushman at that time, and at that time we thought that 21 was a good life. Now we know that, the average gorilla will live in a zoo 38 to 40 years.
So what happened when, during the day, a bear gets out? And I guess that's always a concern for zoos. And when it happens, as long as no one gets hurt, it's an interesting story that gets into the media. But 10 years later, 30 years later, it almost becomes a fun story.
Well, I was fortunate, if you can use that word, to be, I think, the only zoo director that I know of that had four adult gorillas get out of their cage during the time of they were in Lincoln Park. And I remember a call from Marlon Perkins one Sunday morning. I was living out in Riverside at that time, and he said, "Let's get down here quick. Sinbad's out."
Wow.
And I thought for a minute and said, "Marlon, why call me?" By the time I got to the zoo, Sinbad was back in his cage. But animal escapes are always worrisome, and people sometimes think of even the wild creatures as being little, putty cat teddy bears. Wildlife and wild creatures remain potentially dangerous throughout their life.
So I mentioned Pat earlier. Wonderful woman, one of the first women to be a curator at a zoo. She told me a story that you'll have to tell me if it can possibly be true. So at that time, again, you wouldn't do this today, but at that time, she brought a baby orangutan to do a TV segment. And she took a taxi, and the orangutan babies look very much, they really do, like human babies. They truly do. If you don't believe me, Google it, friends. It's true. So she's got, but they're clearly not people. So she has this baby orangutan all wrapped up, bundled up, cold outside, hops into the cab, way before Uber, hops into the cab, says, "Bring me to WGN-TV or wherever she was going. She gets there, pays the money. Cab driver turns around and says, "Lady, I've got to say this. This is the ugliest baby I've ever seen."
If Pat says that, I believe that that's a good story. And I can only say this, that originally the zoo was a male-dominated institution. The Park District Civil Service said 21 years of age, live in Chicago, and be male. And Pat was one of the two women that were the first among the many now fine, great women animal people at Lincoln Park Zoo. So Pat was a pioneer of her day.
Now, I think you told me, she sure was. I think you told me the following story. Somebody did. I'm not making this up. That at some point in time, and it might have been well before you started, I mean, Lincoln Park Zoo was always in the heart of the city, and it's, of course, still is. A bear got out. Now, I don't understand how this can be true, but you are the one who will tell me that a bear got out. Again, this is even before your time. A bear got out, somehow wandered into a nearby bar, and nobody completely cared. Now, can that be true?
I would say anything's possible in a bar. People there had a few drinks. Why would they worry about a bear? But in the early years, Steve, in the early years, in the late, 1900s, a lot of creatures could and would get away. And there are many stories. Some of them are in the book. And happily, most of them ended up in a good way. There's even a story about a sea lion got out of the zoo and went into Lake Michigan, and people were looking for it for a long time. A flamingo took off from the children's zoo. It had not been properly surgically corrected, so it couldn't fly away, and for a week, the media gave me a hard time with sightings of this flamingo up and down the lakefront of Chicago.
Was the sea lion ever recovered, or the flamingo?
The sea lion never surfaced back in Chicago. The flamingo did.
Oh, poor sea lion. There's not much to eat for a sea lion, I don't think, in Lake Michigan. Well, Dr. Fisher, you've certainly made an impression on Chicago. Chicagoans who do remember, they remember you fondly with a smile like I do. What do you think your biggest contribution was?
Oh, I think just to make sure that everyone at Lincoln Park felt welcome. From my first day, the kids from the neighborhood, people of all kinds, to me that was literally part of my salary, to watch people come and enjoy their zoo. And Lincoln Park today is probably a great facility for that reason, that everyone in Chicago comes and enjoys, and I feel good seeing that, Steve.
Well, you ought to. You deserve a lot of credit for it. In fact, have a building named for you. I've got a pencil named for me. You have a building named for you, and deservedly so. Dr. Lester Fisher, thank you for all you've done, a career of making a difference, and we've just touched on some of that. You served on the board of Anti-Cruelty Society for decades, also Animal Care and Controls Commission, and the list goes on and on. Dr. Lester Fisher, thank you so much for being a part of my life and for joining us on the radio.
Well, Steve, thanks for sharing thoughts today, and I hope this will be a good year for both of us. My best to you and WGN.